The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We're back for hour two at 6:05. So good to have you here on this beautiful Colorado Easter weekend. High today was around 65. We expect more warmth tomorrow, 63, maybe 65 degrees. Then we get cooler. We could see 70s by the end of this week. So hang on to your hats. Spring and summer are heading in. Our phone number, 303-696-1971, 696-1971. We'll get back to your calls here in just a little bit. Breaking news from the Babylon Bee. Joe Biden has issued another proclamation condemning Jesus Christ for rising again on the Trans Day of Visibility. So put that in your pipe and smoke it. We need one of those little sound effects, I think, Lewis. We'll have to use that next time. But anyway, we've got an awful lot to do tonight. We are hoping to hear briefly from my good friend, my actual real good friend, attorney, professor, constitutional scholar, John Eastman. He's got a short break between flights. He's going to try and give us a call here in the 7 o'clock hour. But right now, been talking about it earlier. We got into some side conversation about Frank Marshall Davis and Barack Hussein Obama. We're headed live to California, where we're joined by my friend, filmmaker, documentarian, author, and if you check Wikipedia, right-wing conspiracy theorist, Joel Gilbert joins us now. Joel, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you, Randy. Thank you.
Better believe it. And, of course, the hottest topic we'll get to in just a minute is the Democrat presidential candidate. You have been the person who's been shouting the alarm that it's going to be Michelle Obama. She's going to be dropped in at the last minute. We'll see if, as circumstances are playing out, you still hold true to that belief. But before we do, because we got a little sidetracked in the first hour regarding Frank Marshall Davis, who you have argued produced a wonderful film that in my book proves, and I certainly believe, Frank Marshall Davis, the Soviet communist or whatever it was his background was, is actually Barack Hussein Obama's biological father. And I always tell people, just throw up the pictures. You can even Google it. As biased as Google is, you'll get the picture of Frank Marshall Davis. Stick it up there alongside Barack Hussein Obama. Stick Barack Obama Sr. up there in the mix. And tell me who's who. And I noticed on your Twitter feed, which I was looking at before we brought you on, that you've been pointing out some new information about that as well.
Right. Well, look, I made the film Dreams for My Real Father back in 2012. I think everybody's seen it more than once. And I think I made the case that the man who raised Barack in Hawaii, who radicalized him by his own admission, was Frank Marshall Davis, that this was also his biological father. Obama looks nothing like the Kenyan Obamas. The Kenyan Obamas are from the Luau tribe in Kenya, and they have very distinct features. They have a 45-degree angle sloped forehead. It's not 90 degrees. It's sloped backwards. They have large teeth with big gaps in between them. And I'm very friendly, actually, with Malik Obama, the actual child of Barack Obama Sr., the Kenyan student. He looks just like that, whereas Barack Obama looks nothing like the Kenyan Obamas, light-skinned. I think Frank Marshall Davis was not 100% African-American, and Obama just has all the characteristics, the tight, straight teeth, the forehead, the eyes, the look. He's even got this genetic condition of moles that come up with age that Frank Marshall Davis had. So, look, I made the case, and it's clear that Barack got his socialism, his worldview, by being raised by Frank Marshall Davis, who was a Chicago communist who came out of the early group of black Bolsheviks in Chicago, the blacks that were recruited by the Communist Party members that were trying to use them to recruit blacks to the communist movement. Didn't work out very well at the time because blacks were very religious people. They wanted nothing to do with socialism, which taught a war between the classes. They believed in Christianity, which was love of thy neighbor. Barack later took on that role in Chicago. He worked in the 80s for these white liberals, and his job was to be the front man to penetrate the black churches to try to convince them to join these groups. So this, if you watch Dreams from My Real Father, it's on you know, on Vimeo, on Amazon, just Google it. It's on Roku, and you can see the whole history right there.
It is a fascinating movie, and if you look at, for instance, pictures of Barack Obama back in his early days before he had a nose job and a lower lip surgery, his nose and Frank Marshall Davis's nose, literally, you could just pop one off and put it on the other, and it wouldn't change their appearance a bit. No resemblance at all to the purported Barack Obama Sr. So I highly encourage people to go back to that movie. And, you know, it's still somewhat relevant because it's clear to me that Barack Obama is pulling the strings for the grand puppet Joe Biden. Shows up for this big fundraiser in New York while, you know, Donald Trump is attending the funeral of a fallen police officer. Shows up in England to meet with the prime minister. Just really kind of bizarre timing. And it all leads us back to, you know, Barack Obama can't run again. But he's got a wife who could get plucked into that White House. And according to you, at least recently, and for, gosh, what, 2 years now, you think that's still going to happen?
Yeah, I've been making the case. You can see my film. It's called Michelle Obama 2024. It's on Amazon Prime Video. It's on Salem Now. You can live stream it. It's also a book. And I did a deep dive into Michelle's background, number one, and I find out she's a very political person. She's more political than Barack. She's a better politician than Barack. She comes from a political family. Her father was a precinct captain in Chicago working for the Democrat Party machine. Her father had a patronage job, meaning he had a job that was an easy gig at the water department in exchange for getting out the black voters for the white liberals in Chicago. Michelle grew up in Jesse Jackson's house. She said she's seen it all. She grew up in his house because she was good friends with his daughter Santita when Jesse was running for president in the early 80s. So Michelle, you know, she said she only fell in love with Barack once he gave a political speech that she liked. So she's actually the better politician in the family, better speaker. And I make the case that she's been pretty much copying everything that Barack did before he ran for president. Barack had a voter registration organization called Project Vote. Sure enough, Michelle founded a group called When We All Vote, got $26 million from George Soros. She's been pushing voter registration. Barack was the keynote speaker who introduced John Kerry at the 2004 Democrat convention. Sure enough, there was Michelle introducing Joe Biden. And, you know, lastly, Barack wrote two autobiographies before he ran for president. Sure enough, Michelle wrote her best-selling Becoming and also The Light We Carry, which, as I read them, are political documents. It's not a real autobiography. She's kind of setting herself up for politics and papering over a lot of things, which I found her biggest liability was her exploitation of the black community in Chicago, how she knocked down their homes working for the mayor of Chicago to make money for the white liberals. She also denied access to health care for the black community at the University of Chicago Medical Center, made a ton of money. Whenever white liberals had problems with black people and they couldn't hire a white person to do the dirty work, Michelle would do those jobs. So she has a terrible relationship with the black community, and that's her biggest vulnerability, and that's what I point out in the film. But as you mentioned, you know, Barack, we know he's been there behind the scenes. He's kind of come out of the woodwork the past week. They raised $25 million in New York City at Radio City Music Hall. I'm sure every dime of that was for Obama. If Obama had not shown up, no one would have shown up. They wouldn't have gotten any money. So I think the fix is in. I think the Democrats are done with Joe Biden. He's an old white guy. He can barely function. And I think Michelle is just kind of waiting. We don't know how it's going to go down, but I think it'll go down just before the Democrat convention in Chicago, of all places, Michelle's hometown. And I do expect them to substitute in Michelle, and I think it'll be very welcomed by Democrats. They love the Obamas. It'll shore up the hemorrhaging of the minority voters that are going to Trump. And Michelle can fill stadiums. She really can bring back the enthusiasm.
People known to you and I who were concerned about the possibility of Michelle Obama were actually trying to find other people to consider running for president, people who could sort of combat that you know, all of the boxes that someone like Michelle Obama checks off. And obviously it's going to be Donald Trump who is facing whomever becomes the Democrat nominee. What's your analysis of how a Michelle Obama-Donald Trump race would go?
Well, if they do it at the convention, which is only going to be a short time, about 10 weeks to run up to the convention, I mean, that's a relatively short time. The media is going to go crazy over Michelle. She can fill up stadiums and give these great speeches. Anybody that questions her is going to be called out for racism and sexism, of course, at this point. Michelle is a pop culture phenomenon. She's been on hundreds of TV shows, hundreds of magazine covers. She has 100 million social media followers. She has the Obama machine called Organizing for America. It's been around for years. They just flip a switch, and they can do everything to get out the vote for Michelle. So I think the key is to for Donald Trump to highlight Michelle Obama's biggest vulnerability that I mentioned. That's her exploitation and abuse of the black community in Chicago, how she exploited them for money and how she mistreated them. He just has to start tweeting, get back on Twitter, not just social through social. But if he just tweeted, Michelle, are you going to apologize for what you did to the black community in Chicago? Michelle, why did you deny access to health care to the black community? Michelle, why did you knock down their homes for money? That'll open up a whole can of worms, because black voters are no fools, and they don't like sellouts. The worst thing in the black community is if somebody in their community becomes a sellout and sells them down the river for money. And that's what Michelle did, and that's why she's been telling these phony stories for years about having suffered racism growing up. She falsely claims she's from the South Side. She's not from the South Side of Chicago. She's from South Shore, which was a exclusive community on Lake Michigan. She went to exclusive schools. Her and her brother refused to go to South Shore High School, one block from their house. Beautiful high school, very good school, but it was all black. They wouldn't study with black kids, so Michelle went to a magnet school an hour and a half away. Her brother went to a Catholic school, expensive, to study with only white kids. That's why Michelle even writes in her book about being called an Oreo by the other black kids, meaning you're black on the outside, but you're really a white girl on the inside. They would beat her up. Michelle was afraid to go out of her house. She even says, I got her on tape, she says she was afraid. She lived in fear because the black kids knew she didn't have any black friends, and she considered herself an elitist. So this is what I think is Michelle's vulnerability, is the core voting group of the Democrat Party. They need about 90-95% of black voters to come out for their candidates, and I don't think they'll appreciate it. And I think so far it might be one reason why Michelle hasn't declared yet, is because they know that my film and my book expose her life story that she's been pushing as just as phony as Barack's, just as phony. And that's why Michelle and Barack are so perfect together, because they really are a couple of Oreos, like the kids used to call Michelle. They're black on the outside, but they're white on the inside, and they use and manipulate minorities to get political power.
And you really have to wonder, given the surge in the black community toward Donald Trump, just remarkable numbers, whether a celebrity, an Obama coming back, could pull those people back away. According to the Daily Mail, about a week ago, Barack Obama has warned Joe Biden twice in the last year that Trump will win in 2024. But then today, just an hour or so ago, they came up with a poll that said Donald Trump beats even Michelle Obama in a hypothetical 2024 election, 47-44. Now, I don't know any of the numbers inside that poll, but just interesting how the headlines are playing out, given your hypothesis.
Well, I think Obama has been involved in advising the campaign that Biden is going to lose to set up the justification for removing him. They're not listening to me and, the polls. And Michelle would bring back the minority community. Look, at least from the Democrats' point of view, they look at black voters as people who aren't sophisticated. I think if we just put someone up with the same skin color, they'll vote for him. Now, that has been true to some extent over the years, but I think they've wised up. That's why as soon as Biden got into office, they started appointing blacks to all these positions like UN ambassador, defense secretary, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Supreme Court. Everywhere they could appoint someone black, so they could tell black voters, hey, look, we have people that look like you. You should vote for us. I think it's rather insulting, and I think the black community has come a long way, and they understand how good it was under Trump. Trump delivered for the black community what the Democrats had promised for 60 years and not done. Prison reform, a robust economy, school choice, you name it. So I think the memory is there, and I think they're going to try with Michelle. And look, she does bring plausibility. In other words, if Joe Biden wins, based on the mail-in ballots, go for 100% for Joe, no one's going to believe it. Everyone's going to say, well, they cheated again. They cheated. If Michelle wins, people say, well, I guess I believe it because she's so popular. You'd kind of believe it. She brings this plausibility to those people that like to harvest ballots.
Just fascinating stuff. Text messages are coming in. Dan Bongino says, no way for Michelle. Let's see. Here was another one that, we've got friends up in Nebraska. Rush Limbaugh, they say, predicted years ago that Michelle Obama would be tossed in and that she'd be prepared to come in and save America. I didn't recall that, but wouldn't surprise me, the prognosticator extraordinaire. I guess my last question before we run out of time here with Joel Gilbert, two questions, actually. And so I don't forget it like I always do. What's the best place for people to go to see your books, to track down your movies, and especially the most relevant one right now, Michelle Obama 2024?
Yeah, MichelleObama24.com. You can see the website, the trailer, link up to buy the book and the movie. The movie you can live stream on SalemNow.com or Amazon Prime Video. The book and DVD are on Amazon.com.
Very good. And last question is anyone in the orbit of Donald Trump and his campaign aware of the extensive work you've done and the amount of information that's easily, readily available to be used if they do dive bomb her in, as you have predicted and as I have pontificated with my audience as well?
Yeah, I think, well, certainly a lot of people close to Trump are very well aware of it, including Roger Stone, who's endorsed the book and film a long time ago. Trump has been asked directly in the last 6 months many times by Monica Crowley, by Maria Bartiromo and others, straight up, how would you do against Michelle Obama? So he knows it's out there. I'm the only one who's done a deep dive into Michelle's history. So I did it well in advance so this information would be available, because Michelle is a politician. You know, Mr. Bongino doesn't understand. People bought into the story that she doesn't like politics, but she used that as an excuse. In 2008, she was so political, giving these nasty anti-American speeches all over the country, when she said, one day she said, well, Barack, I'm proud of my country for the first time in my life because Barack won a primary. So when that happened, she got so much backlash. The next week she said, I don't like politics. I just want to be the mom in chief. And people bought into that, and it's not true. She's more political than Barack. She's a better politician, and she comes across more authentic. She's really the power. They're kind of like the Clintons, where Hillary was the force behind Bill, and Bill was kind of this disorganized, friendly guy that was kind of popular. It's the same thing with the Obamas. Michelle has always been the force behind Barack. She was his campaign treasurer when he ran for state senate in Illinois. She pushed him to run for Senate. She's always been campaigning for him. So I think it's coming, and you know, go to MichelleObama24.com. You can see the entire case laid out right there.
We're about 7 months and maybe a week away from Election Day, the convention, Republican convention end of July, Democrat convention in August. So
in Chicago, of all places, Michelle's hometown. No, what a coincidence.
Go figure.
Wonder why.
Joel Gilbert, it's always a pleasure. How do people follow you on social media? What's the best place for them to see all of your work?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter all the time. It's Joel S., initial, middle initial S., Joel S. Gilbert, and highway61ent.com. You can see all my films, and you can also link up to all of them on Twitter. Again, joelsgilbert.com, and We'll stay in touch on this as we move forward.
Absolutely. As things progress, we'll have you back. Good to talk to you. Have a good Easter weekend, and take good care out there in the People's Republic.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right, 6:24, 6:25 now. We're running pretty late on the break, so we're going to jump there. Our phone number, 303-696-1971. We're open lines through the end of the show unless we get a quick sneak-in phone call from my good friend, professor, constitutional scholar, still an attorney in some places. John Eastman's going to try and grab us between flights, probably around the 7 o'clock hour. But other than that, it's you and me. Whole lot to do with you, so stay right there on 710 KNUS. It's King Herod's song from Jesus Christ Superstar. And again, it was very early this morning, and I was just looking for a different approach to Easter tomorrow. But Jesus Christ Superstar pops up for me for a couple of personal reasons. I remember when Andrew Lloyd Webber's rock opera first came out, and it was rock and roll, and it was about Jesus, and it was thought to just be the most, hateful and it was just an evil thing. That's what you heard from, real strong old time Christians. And I loved the music. And I listened to Jesus Christ Superstar so many times that even to this day, as a teenager, it came out in 1970, 71. 71 is when the album that I had was released with Ian Gillan, the lead singer for Deep Purple, playing Jesus Christ. Amazing, amazing vocals in that version of the rock opera. And I liked the music so much. My brother introduced me to it right before Easter. Probably in 1971, could have been 1972. I would have been, 13 years old. And I've listened to it so many times that even to this day now, I'll be 65 this year, and I can still sing every, and not sing it well, but I can sing every word of Jesus Christ Superstar. I've just heard it that many times and love it so much. But the connection for me that made it special was that my brother and we, my family life and growing up as a kid had some tough times. But I had wonderful parents who always loved me and that I always loved. So in spite of the ups and downs, that foundation is what's most important. But we were not going to church at that point. Both of my parents had different religious beliefs. And my brother invited my dad to come up, and he'd been critical about, because he'd read, what people were writing about Jesus Christ Superstar. And my brother, who was 4 years older than me, so he would have been 16, maybe 17, invited my dad up to my room, because I had the best stereo in the house, to listen to Jesus Christ Superstar. So we all did it together, the three of us, and my mom was not there. And we listened to the whole thing. And during my dad's dad was the family preacher. I'm sorry, the town preacher, the town lawyer, and the town newspaper editor for the town that he raised my dad and his eight brothers and sisters, one who died very early, but a total of 9 kids. And so he was a very special man. He performed the wedding ceremonies for all of my aunts and uncles and my dad and mom. So, Jesus Christ and Christianity and all that, very, very important to my dad, even though we were not, heavy, intense, church-going, ritualistic sort of people. He came up to be with his sons and to listen to this rock opera, which he had no interest in whatsoever, and he was literally crying by the time they got to the part where Jesus is flogged. The 39 lashes. And we had wonderful conversation about God and Christ and Easter and what the resurrection was all about. And it was one of the most enlightening religious experiences of my young life up to that time. And so I guess for me, and maybe this is why I've taken this different approach to our Saturday night before Easter music, is you just never know what's going to hit you, the different ways that people try to communicate and the different things that can make a difference. And I remember, before my dad died in 2020, I took him on his last trip, and we drove all the way to New York in the winter. We had a blast. He was in a wheelchair, had to load him in and load him out, and we drove by every house that we had lived in, one in Chicago, one in Ohio, on our way to New York, to visit his youngest brother, who was also the last remaining sibling, my last remaining uncle or aunt, on that side of the family. And We listened to Godspell, which my brother, who was a tremendous singer, performed in for a year as a high schooler. And we listened to him singing. We listened to Jesus Christ Superstar. And we had those same experiences again, that closeness to God, that closeness to each other, that reminder in a whole different format, you know, not your traditional church service, that's for sure. So I don't know. I just thought I would share that with you. And one more quick story, and then we'll get on with the rest of the show. Our phone number, 303-696-1971, 696-1971. There was a time in my life where I was single. My brother had passed away. I was long before I became a lawyer. I was still doing cars and doing other things and, you know, trying to figure my way. And I was attending a church, a Baptist church, and I was running their... Well, it's not a Baptist. It was a non-denominational church. It was a really twangy Southern Baptist minister who was a Bible scholar, who read in the original languages, the original Hebrew, the original Greek. And so his teaching was just phenomenal. And they brought a guy named Jeff Fenhold to Colorado to perform. And he performed up at, I forget the name of that theater, the Bluebird or something over up there on North Federal Boulevard, one of the old, you know, last few remaining movie theaters, traditional old style movie theaters sprinkled around town. And I didn't know anything about him. And then I found out that Jeff Fenholt had played Jesus Christ on I think it was in New York. And he is the person portraying Jesus Christ on Time Magazine's cover as when Jesus Christ was Man of the Year back in the 70s. And so I thought, wow, you know, this guy's a rock and roller. And I learned a little bit about him. He'd played with Black Sabbath and done all kinds of things. And then his experience playing Jesus Christ on Broadway actually caused his conversion, not immediately, but he came. I got to know him. I got to talk about him. I got to talk with him. And according to him, his conversion became slowly. He became very dissatisfied with his life, his rock and roll life, his mansion, his this, his that. And it just all became tumultuous inside of him. And eventually he accepted Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. And so he took his tremendous talent. His singing was amazing. He couldn't drive worth a crap. I picked him up at the airport in a little Porsche 911 that I had, and it was a stick shift. And he said, "Oh my God, I've always wanted to drive a Porsche." And I said, "Okay." I never wanted to hog a car. It's just a car. And it was a big mistake because the dude, oh man, grinding the gears. But his testimony and then his musical performances, singing sort of rock and roll tinged gospel in a packed movie theater that was sort of converted into a church for the night. Just incredible. And so he got converted by actually playing Jesus Christ in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar. So anyway, those are some significant experiences that I had, and I thought it would be interesting to share those with you. And so I did. And so we're not going to have time for calls because or any other conversation right now, because I just heard from John Eastman, and he's landed early. So I think what I'd like to do, Lewis, is let's go ahead and take our break right now. We'll see if we can line up my actual good friend, a professor, constitutional scholar, and still attorney, John Eastman. And we'll talk to him next when we return here on 710 KNUS. Talk about controversy, 1971, from Jesus Christ Superstar. That was Yvonne Elliman. The song became a major hit, you know, on just pop radio. But got a text message to studio that said, "Randy, I saw Jesus Christ Superstar on Broadway. Not impressed. Somewhat of a blasphemous production, if you ask me. Love your show anyway. Thank you, Texter." And I would love that Texter to call in because I would love to hear more about that. 303-696-1971. Of course, some of the controversy around "I Don't Know How to Love Him" is Mary Magdalene, prostitute, saying Jesus is just a man. But, you know, if you put yourself into her shoes, before witnessing miracles, seeing this man who appeared as nothing more than a man on earth. I thought it was a very touching way to, you know, assess or think about or comprehend what a difficult situation that must have been for just human beings in general. And so, I don't know. That's all we're going to play from Jesus Christ Superstar tonight. Another text, have the Godspell movie soundtrack. Love that one too. We are very close in age. Yeah. Both of those albums, as I discussed a few moments ago, just bring such memories for my deceased brother and this particular time of year. And I love your feedback on it. But we have been hoping and praying that we would be able to connect with my good friend John Eastman as he is between flights headed from point A to point C. And he is calling in and checking in with us right now. Professor, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Randy, for having me back on.
Better believe it. And I don't know what your time is like. We have about 9 minutes, maybe 10 minutes before we have to cut out. So we'll try and just jump to it. You may be surprised to know we heard this on our very own station this morning by a witness in our preliminary injunction hearing in our effort to stop the semi-open primary here in Colorado, Prop 108. Dick Wadhams came on the air here and told everybody that after a 3 or 4 day trial, one in which he testified, that the judge found no merit to our arguments or our allegations and our case is over. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, that's as false as the various claims in the bar court ruling in California against me this week.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the Oppenheimer movie, somebody asks Robert Oppenheimer, what do you want? He said, I want people to start telling the damn truth again.
Yeah.
And that's what we have. I mean, Dick Wadhams lied. It was not a 3 or 4 day trial. We had a day of hearing. It was a hearing on a preliminary injunction. And the court said we hadn't met the high standards for getting a preliminary injunction. And we're now proceeding to discovery with discovery going in the next couple of months, ending in May or June, and then dispositive motions. That's called motions for summary judgment coming in June or July. And then we'll have a trial if none of those pan out one way or the other. We'll have a trial beginning sometime in the fall or early after the first of the year. That's the status of the case. It's very much alive. And there's lots to do on it. Dick Wadhams is just flat-out lying.
Yeah, it's just incredible where you'd make up information like that. And unfortunately, the mistruths continued because, you know, the whole controversy on this station circles around an interview that you did with Peter Boyles, an interview that he requested that me and his good friend Chuck Bonniewell set up. And that didn't go very well because he made a stupid and uninformed comment about affidavits, repeated again today that affidavits are meaningless in court, and you hung up on him. And
he made this stupid comment about affidavits being meaningless, which of course is stupid. Anybody knows affidavits are evidence. They're sworn evidence. But he compared it to somebody, you know, claiming that Bigfoot existed. And that was just nonsense. And so I said, I'm not here. I don't want to waste my time with such nonsense. Get serious and I'll be happy to talk with you. And then I left because he was not serious. And he's apparently ever since taken that as a badge of honor that I left his show. What an idiot.
Well, it just bothers me. I mean, my former brother and his claim now, and I heard it live today, and I, you know, nobody likes me to talk about this. Maybe my last night on the air. I don't know. But the claim is that we set up this interview, that we set him up for this interview. That interview was done at his request by his good friend Chuck Bonniewell and his former brother and Harley riding pal, me. With no ill intention. In fact, after that interview, I was out riding and got multiple calls enough so that I pulled over on the highway to call Peter back. And he was just so worried about it. He wanted to get you back and all kinds of stuff. So I just, you know, I can't stand the lying, John.
That's the world we live in. The major media, I've taken to calling. Rush Limbaugh used to call him the drive-by media because they would take drive-by hits at people when you couldn't respond. I now call them the propaganda media. They develop a narrative for an agenda, And all the lies, the more they repeat it, they think it becomes true because it sinks in. And, you know, it's like, calling Trump's efforts against the 2020 election the big lie. Well, the real big lie is calling him a big lie, because there was lots of evidence of illegality and fraud, and they want to pretend it doesn't exist. And as a result, people will forget about it. Well, they stole the damn election. I mean, let's be very clear. There's no question about it in my mind. We've gotten confirmation now to that out of a serious investigative report that was done by former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman up in Wisconsin. We've gotten confirmation of that out of forensic analysts that was done down in Georgia. They are still 120,000 more ballots than voters in Pennsylvania that cannot be reconciled. These are the kind of things. There were 35,000 ballots injected into the system in Arizona after they left the county clerk's office and went to a private vendor. And, you know, they have to do a chain of custody. And then when it came back, there were 35,000 more ballots than went in. This is the kind of stuff that's verifiably true. And in each of those instances, it's more than the margin of victory. And so the people that keep insisting that there was no there, and anybody that says there was should be disbarred or criminally prosecuted, are themselves the ones that ought to be disbarred or criminally prosecuted.
Yeah, and more surveillance footage is coming out, blank ballots being brought in, prosecutions underway, or at least investigations, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. I flip it around when, you know, I've always been called in the media around here and by others an election denier, and I just flip it around. They're election fraud deniers because,
yeah.
And we heard, you know, you hear this all the time, 62 court cases determined there was no evidence. Take just 30 seconds and put that lie back to bed.
So, first of all, there were more than 100 cases. Almost none of them were addressed on the merits. And those that were, Trump won about three quarters of them on minor merits issues. Most of them were dismissed for lack of standing because they were brought by individual citizens, not by the campaign, or by because they were brought too soon, or because they were brought too late, or various other procedural issues without ever reaching the merits. And so anybody ever tells you that 65 courts and 100 judges, you know, said that Trump had no evidence. That's just another one of these damn lies. But they keep repeating it, figuring if they repeat it often enough, people will think it's true. It's not true. It's completely false. And so, you know, we've got to stand for the truth here. I mean, it's important because what they did, it was launch a coup. And I got to give them credit. They successfully blamed the people that were trying to expose it as if we were the ones that were trying to launch the coup. But they launched the coup and they succeeded in it. But if we're going to be free Americans in charge of our government, a self-governing people, then we have got to insist that these kind of illegalities be put to rest. But they get so visceral about it. And I've been trying to think why. I mean, they've been cheating so long on the Democrat side. I mean, you know the old joke, the guy in Boston left in his will. He wanted to be buried in Chicago, and his lawyer asked him why he wanted that in the will. He said, I've been active in politics my whole life. I want to stay active. You know these jokes because there's truth to it. I mean, they've been cheating in Chicago ever since the Kennedy-Nixon election in 1960. Everybody knows it. They've been paying walk-around money to get people to vote in Maryland for decades, and everybody knows it. And yet when we caught them doing it in Nevada, giving gift cards to Indians on the reservation if they voted, that's illegal. It's an illegal vote. It's fraud. And we called them on it. And they just said, you know, how dare you? They've been doing it so long, they feel like they're entitled to it. And then you add the Trump derangement syndrome on top of that. They just go bonkers when you try and expose what they're doing.
Well, and the answer you'll get when you do point out a case here or a case there, well, that's not enough to change the election. You know, it's just it really
well,
does.
They should read Mike Gabelman's report.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the margin in Wisconsin was a little over 20,000. He identified 150 to 200,000 illegal votes in that election. And I guarantee you most of those are for Biden. Well, 10 times the margin of victory in that race. So anybody that tells you that there was not enough to affect the outcome is lying. Including Bill Barr, who, you know, famously said he didn't see any evidence of fraud. Well, he didn't do any investigations. We now know that because people have filed Freedom of Information Act requests to get the information about the investigations. And it doesn't come back with an answer that all investigative materials aren't subject to disclosure. It comes back with an answer, no available materials exist. That means they didn't do the investigations that he falsely said they did. These are the kind of things that we're confronting.
Yeah, and, you know, gosh, we're 4 years removed now, and it's taken... Go ahead.
Yeah, people tell me, why don't you look forward instead of backwards? I said, because what's ahead of us will be on steroids what was behind us if we don't expose and fix what they did on the last election. And that's why I stay laser focused on trying to expose it and get people to realize the threat to our system of government that this stuff poses.
I spoke to our mutual friend Garland Favorito a few weeks ago. We had him on the air. He wound up being here for well over an hour. And so for people who doubt or say there's never been a trial, there's never been any evidence, there was a 4-week-long trial in Georgia. You can find the details at voterga.org, voterga.org. And you had a months-long trial, too, where actual evidence now exists in the record. The result of that has been a judge's ruling to take your bar license. I know that fight is a long ways from over. We've only got about a minute left in this segment. Do you have any time on the other side before you have to go catch your plane so we can just give?
I don't. We've got to run to catch it, and they'll be boarding as soon as we get there.
But you're
right. The judge's order recommending disbarment ignores all of the massive amount of evidence we put on at trial as if it never existed.
Well, it doesn't even address it. I mean, she doesn't even say, well, the state said this and Mr. Eastman said that, and I just don't believe Mr. Eastman. She ignores your evidence, some of it incontrovertible.
Exactly. Yep. No, that's but it's what we've done is moved into an authoritarian world. The government has spoken. And anybody that challenges must be lying. And you just got to bend your knee to what the government tells you to do. That means we're no longer free citizens in a self-governing republic. We've become servants or subjects of a more increasingly tyrannical government.
Without a doubt. And, John, you'll be glad to know I wasn't sure we were going to be able to get you given the tightness of your flights. So I went ahead and cut your about 7-minute interview with Steve Bannon on War Room up, where you actually get to talk about the bar trial and put some details on the record, and I'll play that for the audience in the final hour of the show. Safe travels, my friend. Thank you for taking a minute to join us here in Denver.
Thank you very much, and tell people where they can go to my gift.
Yes.
go.com easement. That'd be very helpful.
You got it.
Thanks,
I will do that for sure. Yeah, you bet. You too. Millions of dollars that have had to be extended to continue to try and defend this man. And how pathetic that some people are relishing in these left-wing lawfare attacks on a very good man. But that tells you everything you need to know about them, doesn't it? All right, final hour of the show just ahead.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.